you an introduction to some aspects of quantum gravity and also some aspects of general relativity in its classical form. And the rough plan of these lectures, I will try to cover the following 4 points. The meaning of diffeomorphism invariants, and constrained systems, both at the classical and quantum level, then the canonical formulation of general relativity, where by canonical I mean, as you have probably seen already in your classical mechanics lectures, the Hamiltonian approach to mechanics. Then, and hopefully I should be able to cover these in the first 1.5 class, and then in the rest of the time we can have fun with the most advanced stuff, in the sense of closer to the research line, and I will describe you what spin networks are, and I will show you how the quantization of space-time arises. So my idea behind these classes is to, instead of just giving you glimpse of what the theory looks like and results, I would like to try to start from concepts and basic aspects of mathematics that you probably already know or that we can develop together to try to build it up from scratch and see how these aspects all come to play in the same direction and offer an interesting physical picture. And in order to try to build it from scratch, I would like to start from the most basic principle that might be behind our understanding of gravity at the classical level, even before that at the quantum level. And this is the equivalence principle. This principle can be stated in many ways, but it's basically an experimental fact. It's something that we see in everyday experiments, and not only in everyday experiments, but also in movies, for instance, if you have if you have a lift that breaks down and so the lift is free falling, then you know from Hollywood movies that the people inside would sort of be floating inside the lift. And in more technical words, what we say is that in a sufficiently small region, basically a lift, for instance, then inertial and the gravitational forces can cancel to any accuracy by going to a free-falling system, reference system. Oh, an interesting other example, not the lift, is the one of the spacecraft in orbit around the Earth, where also the people are floating inside the spaceship, so that in spite of the fact that you might think that the spaceship is just orbiting around the Earth, technically it's a free-falling system. And if you want, the origin of these in formulas is the fact that when I write the gravitational force according to Newton's law, so I write that F is equal to Newton's constant, and then let's say I have a bigger body acting on a smaller body of mass, small m, divided by r squared, then let's say the charge of the body that is attracted, so the strength with which is attracted, is actually equivalent to the inertial mass that appears in the second law, in Newton's second law of dynamics. So the fact that, in principle, I could call this inertial mass, and this I could call the gravitational mass, the experimental evidence that these two quantities are the same is what is behind this equivalence principle. So in Newton's second law of dynamics, you have this concept of acceleration, which is universal. This acceleration is defined with respect to an absolute space and time, which are defined in absolute terms. And so the way Newton defines acceleration is with respect to these, absolute space and time. However, from the point of view of the physics that was in Einstein's mind, the step to make is that this particular space-time that Newton had in mind, which we can call Euclidean, because it would respect the geometry of Euclid, was just a particular manifestation of the gravitational field. So the acceleration was actually absolute, not with respect to an absolute space and time, sorry, was defined not with respect to an absolute space and time, but to a particular solution of a particular expression of the gravitational field. I say the Euclidean because I had in mind just the space part, but we know from special relativity, which I think maybe I've seen to some extent, that we can think of space and time in the same geometrical way, and introduced what is called Minkowski space-time, and introduced a metric on Minkowski space-time, which is basically, I'll be better saying that the metric is what allows you to measure the distance between points. And the way the metric is defined is that in a flat space, you would define the distance, infinitesimal square distance between two points, as the contraction of, sums over the indices of the metric. Sorry, I mean you, with some Cartesian coordinates. Let me call them psi. So this is just a special relativity, which I suppose and hope you are familiar with to some extent, at least. So here, so the key message between, the key message in Einstein's mind at this point, when he was starting to look for an understanding of what it means, this equivalent principle in terms of physical terms, was the fact that everything should be defined with respect to the gravitational field, and in particular that the gravitational field was a dynamical object. It was the dynamical object that would tell you in which specific frame, specific reference frame, the motion is inertial, from what we're seeing here. From basically, it's trying to put into formulas this idea of the equivalence principle. So how do we describe mathematically this idea that the gravitational field is what tells you the reference system in which things are inertial? So imagine that we start with some generic coordinates, x mu, which is a reference system which in general might not be inertial. Then at any point, and here I have my space-time m, so at any point, let's say x0, we can imagine to be able to make a change of coordinates such that locally we are in an inertial frame. So locally, we can define Cartesian coordinates. So this is the point x0, and let me use this notation psi for Cartesian coordinates. So locally, I can introduce some Cartesian coordinates, and now to differentiate the fact that they're Cartesian, I not only use psi, but I also use a different index, I. And these are defined at the point, let's say, x0. So, and these are functions of my original, in general, non-inertial coordinates, x mu. Now imagine that we are considering, so this would be true in the point, and now let's look at this small neighborhood. Of course, I can always choose this reference point of Cartesian coordinates such that x0 is the origin. And then I can imagine to make a Taylor expansion around x0 So a Taylor expansion around x0 would be at the point x0 plus the derivative of xi with respect to the x mu computed at the point x0 times the difference from the reference point x0. So let's say x mu minus x0 mu, OK? And every time, I don't know if you're familiar with this notation yet, but every time I have two indices which appear twice in the same line, we implicitly assume that we are summing over those indices. So with this notation, I mean sums over mu that goes from 0 to 3, OK? Because they're repeated. So this quantity here, let me give it a name. I'm going to call this quantity here E mu I of x0. And this is dxii divided by dx mu computed at the point x0. These are four vectors in each spacetime point. And this is what tells you if you start from a non-inertial frame. As I said, we can always choose the Cartesian coordinate such that the origin is precise in x0. So forget about this term. So these quantities, what tells you, start from non-inertial coordinates, and you rotate to inertial Cartesian coordinates. So this is the gravitational field. This quantity here is the gravitational field according to the equivalence principle. And as I said, these are four vectors for each point. Now, why is it said that the gravitational field is in general the metric of spacetime? You might have heard this. Because let's go back to special relativity. And maybe an eraser at some point would be useful. Here, this definition of the infinitesimal distance between two points. These are differentials. So by using the fact that this is 0, those differentials can be written as the gradient times the differential in the other non-inertial coordinates x mu. So in other words, let me make my notation consistent. I've used indices capital I, capital J for the Cartesian coordinates. And this differential is dxii over dx mu. So this equation here, I can write it as sum over I and j of eta I and j of dxii over dx mu, dxij over dx mu times dx mu, dx nu. Now, let me call this quantity here you really seem to have room issues. This quantity here, let me call it, you see, I'm summing over I and J. So this resulting quantity should not depend on the indices I and J because I'm summing over them, but the indices mu and nu are free, OK? So imagine that this is a matrix in the indices mu and nu. So whatever I call it, it should be something with indices mu and nu. And what I'm going to call it is G with these indices mu and nu, OK? So by this redefinition, I get that ds squared is equal to G mu nu. And here I always had that convention, right? Because the differential is the sum, is the scalar product between the other coordinates and the gradient, right? So there's a sum over mu that is implicit in there, which carries over here when I write the metric interval, the infinitesimal distance between two points, in arbitrary coordinates as the sum over mu nu of this new object now. This new object, g mu nu, which according to that definition is sum over I and J of eta j. And then instead of those derivatives, I can put their new name, the gravitational field, and u j. This is what I call the spacetime metric. And this tells me, you can see these as a, you can think of this as a, some kind of equation between matrices. This matrix here for mu and nu tells you the metric in arbitrary coordinates. This matrix here in I and j tells you the Euclidean metric, or rather the Minkowskian metric in Cartesian coordinates. And the gravitational field is what tells you how you relate the two. Okay? Now, there are a few interesting consequences just starting from that definition there. First of all, you know that a Cartesian reference frame is not unique. So a Cartesian system of coordinates, what I really mean is an inertial reference frame. No, that's what I said that I was trying to construct by using this principle here. But you know that an inertial reference frame is certainly not unique. Any Lorentz transformation would still keep me in an inertial frame. In pre-relativistic physics, any Galilean transformation would have kept me inertial. In relativistic physics, any Lorentz transformation. In other words, that definition I've done there, e mu I equal big psi I over dx mu, has some symmetry properties. One symmetry property is the fact that this psi I could belong to different inertial frames. As I said, different inertial frames are related by Lorentz transformations. And I don't know what notation you've used in your electromagnetic courses or in special relativity. I'm familiar with a notation like this to call a Lorentz transformation. But if you have others in mind, I don't know. So this is a Lorentz transformation. Sorry, this, of course, is the new Cartesian coordinate system for the new boosted or just rotated inertial frame. And this tells us that this index here has properties which are related to Lorentz transformations. Also, in principle here, I've started with x mu. But I could also have decided to now, my non-inertial coordinates, x mu, I could change them as well. So here, I've changed my Cartesian coordinates. But I could also have changed my non-inertial coordinates into some new coordinates x mu, sorry, y mu of x, for instance. So if I do this, what happens is that my gravitational field would, or let's use this notation, would transform into a new gravitational field, which is the Lorentz rotated or boosted of the original gravitational field. If I do this, mu I would go into, this should be y, my new coordinates, and this should be a new index, let's say nu, and here a nu I. So the index I has properties that know about Lorentz transformations. The index mu has properties that know about the system of coordinates, of non-inertial coordinates in general, that they've used to the coordinates you've chosen for your space-time that could be flat or curved. So no, this I'm gonna need it, because now I would like to try to discuss the interpretation of precisely this second transformation here. And for this I need a nice drawing. So let me do it this way. Let's imagine that these are all the possible gravitational fields. This is a set that describes all the possible gravitational fields that I can think of. And let's choose a particular one. I can now make a change of coordinates on the space-time like this and obtain a new one, E prime, okay? And let's say the D prime in this set is up here. So I'm gonna draw the fact that D prime and E are related by a change of coordinates by the fact that in the space of possible gravitational fields, there is a path that links the two. Okay, this path is generated by changing the coordinates from x to y of x. If I go to another function, z of x, new coordinates, I'll keep moving along this path, and my gravitational field will keep changing, okay? So the action of changing the coordinate systems, so this action here is called a diffeomorphism, and it's typically indicated with, let's say, phi. Okay, so phi, it's a change of coordinates, and for our purpose, it'd be useful to specify, to give it an extra name, and the extra name I'm gonna give it is the name of passive diffeomorphism. Passive because it's acting on the choice of coordinates, okay? So on your rulers, if you want. It's not acting on the matter, on the physical content of the theory, just on the coordinates that you choose. However, here comes the big puzzle that sort of got Einstein stuck for a few years. Because, so we said that the gravitational field is what tells you how to be inertial at every point. But then you might want to say that regardless if I'm inertial or not, the laws of physics should be always the same. Just as the Galilean principle of relativity said that the laws of physics were the same in all inertial frames, Einstein was tempted by generalizing this relativity principle, and that's why he was after a theory called the general relativity, in which the laws of physics would be the same in all reference frames. But if this is the way the gravitational field changes under a change of reference frame, then you might be tempted to say, if this is a physical gravitational field, so it's a solution of the dynamics, it's something that exists, then this one also should be a solution of the dynamics, should be a physical field, precisely because I'm asking that it doesn't matter what coordinates I'm using, the physics should always be the same. So if I think of this change of coordinates as something that is actually mapping a particular gravitational field to a new gravitational field, E prime, to differentiate the possible different physical interpretation that could be behind it, I'm gonna refer to that as an active diffeomorphism. So, where is my nice picture? So if you want, if I now imagine that I have a particular value of the gravitational field, now seen not as a function in some coordinate system, but seen as a physical entity, then this diffeomorphism, as seen from an active point of view, is transforming this gravitational field into a new gravitational field. And now the question is, should I take this seriously? What is the meaning of this? If E is a solution, also E prime is a solution? Well, Einstein got stuck not being able to make up his mind for a reason that I'm gonna tell you in a second, that if you really decide to go for what is called covariance, namely that this, if this is a solution, also the transformed one is a solution. So if you try to implement this idea of a general relativity in terms of covariance, then you end up with a puzzle. And the puzzle that Einstein end up with was the following. Imagine that this is space-time, this is an initial time t equals 0. And imagine that at some point you have a solution of your field equations that you're looking for. And in this solution, you have a point A where space is flat. And you have a point B where space-time is not flat. So there's some curvature, okay? So in other words, here you're inertial, there you're not inertial. Well, now let's see what these two things, these two different meanings of diffeomorphisms imply. Well, let me consider the passive first, and let me consider a passive diffeomorphism. So let's say phi passive, such that outside this region that I'm focusing on, nothing happens. So the coordinates outside are still the same. In particular, this is still the initial time equals 0, but something changes inside. I can always imagine to change coordinates, for instance, in such a way that the point A is now here, where space-time is curved, and the point B is here, where space-time is flat. Because I've just changed the coordinates, right? For instance, I've done a translation or a rotation or a more general coordinate transformation. If I see the diffeomorphism from the active point of view, and once again, I'm only looking at changes inside this hole, outside everything stays the same, then I can think that A and B are still there because I'm not changing my coordinate system. From the active point of view, what I'm thinking about is the fact that I'm changing the gravitational field. So I'm moving along the path of gravitational fields, not the path that changes the coordinates. So if I'm changing the gravitational field, it means that here that it was curved, it could become flat, for instance. Here that it was flat, it could become curved. So in particular, I could choose a diffeomorphism such that this region of curved space is moved here, and this region of flat space is moved here. You see, as long as seen just from the passive point of view, you can just imagine that the physics is the same in the sense that space-time was curved there, it was flat there. I've just renamed my points, my reference frame. But if I take the active point of view, now the situation is that the same point that used to be curved now sees flat space-time. So if this is a symmetry of the theory, then that means that there's no point in identifying B as a place where space-time is curved and A as a place where space-time is flat, because I can always imagine a new solution obtained by diffeomorphism where the opposite is true. So the consequence seems to be that, in fact, that there is no meaning behind the space-time point A and the space-time point B. I cannot identify those points as points where something happened, because I could change coordinates, and the theory would not be predictable with respect to a point A. I cannot ask what is space-time, what is the geometry at the point A, because via diffeomorphism, via change of coordinates, the answer would change. So in front of this, Einstein at first sort of backed up, and in fact, it was 4 years from the first paper in 1912 when he discusses the importance of general covariance to when he finally writes down, well, 3 years, in 15, when he finally writes down his covariant equations, in which he finally decides that, yes, it has no sense to talk about the physical meaning of a space-time point. What has sense is just the identification of a space-time point as the point where something physical happens. So imagine now to this same picture that B is not anymore characterized as a point in my reference frame, but is characterized as a point where two particles are actually colliding, or two classical trajectories are intersecting. Then, when I do an active diffeomorphism, the gravitational field is going to be shuffled around in this way, because I've chosen the diffeomorphism such that it does it. But also, all the other fields in my theory are going to suffer the same change. In particular, also these trajectories are going to be modified by my diffeomorphism, and in particular, going to be modified in such a way that their new intersection point, of course, the outside the hole, the trajectory should be the same, so I should probably be drawing something like this. Because if you remember, I assumed that the diffeomorphism was causing nothing outside this hole. So you see that it makes no sense to ask what's the value of the space in a covariant theory, what's the value of the gravitational field at the point B, but it does make sense to ask what's the value of the gravitational field at the point where these two particles are colliding. So what matters is not physics with respect to something absolute that is in the background, but what matters is physics with respect to other physics. So this idea of relationalism, if that's the right way of pronouncing it, that had been around in philosophy and in science also for ages. Newton himself had a very hard time fighting with Descartes and Leibniz, that very much did not like his absolute space and time. So this is the striking consequence of general covariance from the point of view of physical interpretation. A space-time point has no more physical meaning. All that matters is physics of one system related to other physical quantities. How about these famous equations? These famous equations that are supposed to implement this covariant and to try to describe this idea. Well, it turns out that actually they are based, the basic principles without writing down these equations are very few. And it is instructive to actually write them down. So the, this I'm going to use it as a principle. So the field equations that Einstein finally wrote down can be uniquely determined from, of course, this uniquely has to be taken with some grain of salt, but for the purpose of our class, that's just as good, from four principles. So one, this idea of general covariance. So general covariance might sound extremely vague on the basis of what I've just said. I mean, you understand the principle, but how is it going to help you to write down some equations? It does in a very restrictive way, because general covariance means this. Means that you have this notion on your, that in your theory you have indices over which you have this notion of changing coordinates in this way. So quantities, so this for each I is a vector where the index mu goes from 0 to 3 or 1 to 4. It's a vector on this general curved space where I've put my coordinate xi. Okay, this is a vector. Objects which generalize the concept of vector, for instance, if now I have two indices like g mu nu here, these are in general called tensors, okay? So tensors are the right objects in order to describe covariant properties, namely the fact that there's things, there's a well-defined way of transforming things when you change coordinates. So this means basically that there's going to be tensors in the game. Then, what's the source of gravity? Well, we know the answer from Newton, right? The source of gravity is mass. We wrote it right at the beginning, some place down here. No, some other place. Mass is the, oh, here, yes, there you go. Mass is what I said is the charge of gravity, is what is sensible to gravity. However, then 1905, special relativity arrived with the revolution. Mass is not anymore a conserved quantity. Mass depends on the reference frame. what really matters is not mass, it's energy. So maybe if I'm trying to do a theory of gravity that is consistent with special relativity at least, then I should consider the source of gravity is not mass, but is the energy, which was already a giant step ahead, because for instance, it means that things which do not have mass, but carry energy, such as light, should suffer gravity. Now, this was something that at the time was sort of unheard of, but nevertheless, it would lead to quite easy observable consequences. And so Eddington set up this fantastic experiment in which he considered, imagine this is the sun, which is a perfectly shaped olive, and imagine that Earth is here, and we are on top of the Earth looking at the sun. And now, of course, there's not just the sun in the sky, there's plenty of other stars. So let me consider a star that is behind the sun. So is light, the light from this star would travel all the way and reach the Earth, and in particular, when the Earth is on this side of the sun, at night we would be able to observe the light of this star. But now suppose that the moon is right in the way, so that the sun is actually shielded off, then in principle we might be able to observe the light coming from the star also during the day, thanks to an eclipse. So if now light is bent by the gravitational force created by the sun, then the ray of light that comes from the star should be bent, ever so slight, but still it should happen. And what turns out is that it's actually measurable, it's actually can be seen, and Eddington saw it in, what was it, 1920, I think, a solar eclipse somewhere. And so that was the first confirmation of this striking idea that the source of gravity is actually not the mass, but it's the energy. So also things which have no mass can actually gravitate, which means that a photon, which means that light feels gravity, which means that you can have objects such as black holes in which gravity is pulled so much towards the source of gravity they cannot escape. I need to, well, okay, so so we have energy as the source of gravity, so the second principle is the source is gravity. Sorry, the source is energy. And because there have to be tensors in the game, we are gonna call the source the energy tensor. Okay, then it will take a slightly fancier name, energy momentum tensor, but basically that's the idea. Three, we want to recover Newton's law because it turns out that Newton's law is pretty accurate, pretty true at many scales. So we want to recover Newton's law in the non-relativistic limit, which means when you can take the speed of light to be infinite, and so you don't feel the fact that light has a finite speed. And then the fourth was a technical request that I'm gonna write it down because I think it's also instructive, and is the fact that the equations should be at most second order. Oh, and now maybe a more complicated word, but do you know what differential equations are? Perfect, very good. Should be at most differential equations. If you want, you can take these as some kind of working assumptions, in the sense that if you don't take it, first of all, there's many more possibilities. Second, these many more possibilities are theory which until that time had not entered physics, so it wasn't clear what the meaning of those theories could be. These days that we are completely lost in the dark about many problems still open in theoretical physics, we try to explore all possible alternatives, and we love to explore alternatives in which we remove this fourth assumption. But it's very importantly present in Einstein's approach, and is what selects uniquely his equations of motion, which take an extraordinary form, which deserve trying to use this technology. Ah, that was already on. Oh, this, oh, thank you. That sounds like external help. I haven't done anything. In 15 seconds, we'll be able to see the questions. I don't want to spoil the surprise. So let me first have a try if the orientation is correct. Oh, that's me. Oh, look, we have an infinite scene. No, how do... Do I have to do anything to make this work? Trying to call from help from the director. To the head. No, eh? Wait. Maybe this should be turned on. No. I know you would have appreciated if I had said before that I was about to do this, but nevertheless, the improvisation. Video source, of course. Perfect, so I want the orientation. Yeah, no, leave it like this. Yes, please. Yep, I want it like this. So, tra. Einstein's equations on an abandoned train in Colombia. It's true. You can go there on this salt desert, and you will find that somebody has written the Einstein's equations. They are correct. So. Okay, so you see the indices, mu nu, the tensors. Forget about what R is, but you see G mu nu, the metric enters, T mu nu, this is what I've called the energy tensor, and as you can expect, the Newton constants enter, and the speed of light enter, okay? So much for that. And we can turn everything off. And where were we? Yes, so those are the equations. Of course, as you know from classical mechanics, typically the equations of motions, you can imagine that there is an action principle behind, and you can imagine that there's some Euler-Lagrange equation, that these are, sorry, the equations, the Euler-Lagrange equations coming from some Lagrangian. And for general relativity, the action that gives rise to those equations is called the Einstein-Hilbert equation, Einstein-Hilbert action, and is an action for the metric, which I'm not going to write down, but so just that you know. Now, coming from those beautiful equations on the train, of course, you can spend the whole time discussing just about the properties of those equations, and I have to be honest with you that in spite of the fact that the starting point was very clear, a Hollywood falling lift, the result is that those equations are not only extremely complicated, but also lead to very much less clear than the falling lift physical descriptions, which are more, as I said, black holes or exploding universes, which are more like more advanced science fiction films. Nevertheless, it all starts from these very simple assumptions and those equations that can be written on any rusting train. However, yes.
Right, not quantum graffiti.
Classical, yes. However, there is an action. Now, you might have learned, hopefully, in your quantum mechanical courses that, so, I'm not going to talk about classical general relativity. That's all I was wanting to say about it. You will certainly take beautiful courses on it because I strongly recommend it. It's a very beautiful theory. I would like to move to how to quantize this theory and to find the eraser there. And you might know from, you might remember from your quantum mechanical course that a sensible way to do quantum mechanics is that somebody gives you the Hamiltonian of a classical system, where the Hamiltonian you also know, right, from your classical mechanics course. So imagine you have just a system of one particle. So you will have a classical Hamiltonian, which is a function of the variable and the conjugate momentum. And then the meaning of quantization is that you put hats on things, right? So you put a hat on top of P, you put a hat on top of Q, which induces a hat on top of H. And then out of this hat, the rabbit comes, which is the Schrödinger equation. You write down an equation in time, linear in time, which has this operator on the right-hand side and this time derivative on the left-hand side, OK? The Schrödinger equation, which I'm assuming you remember everything about it. So a good starting point to try to apply quantum mechanics to generativity then is, well, give me the Hamiltonian. Sure, sounds like a good question, but the answer to this question is rather disturbing, in fact. And to try to understand the answer to this question, let's go at the beginning. And Hamiltonian is a function of conjugate variables. So what are the conjugate variables in generativity? So here, by conjugate variables, I mean something that classically has a phase space structure, can I say that? In which the Poisson bracket is one. And when I quantize, the things with the hats satisfy the quantum commutator. And instead of one is I H bar, OK? So what are the canonical variables of generativity? Well, what is P? Well, P is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to Q dot. So in order to define P, we need Q dot. And Q dot is dQ over dt. So in order to define Q dot, we need t, time. How can we identify time in our system here, m? Well, let's try to do something sensible. So this is m. I put coordinates x mu. And now let's say that these coordinates x mu, these are four. The first one, I call it t. And the other three, I call it, I keep calling them x. So here I'm saying that the index mu goes from 0 to 3, whereas the index a is only spatial, goes from 1 to 3. Let's imagine I do this. So of course, if these are Cartesian coordinates, then what's happening is that I'm simply slicing Minkowski spacetime into hyperspaces, right? So this would be t equals 0, and this is the way t grows. And this flat hypersurface are my Euclidean 3D, is my Euclidean 3D space at each instant of time. However, if now spacetime is curved, and these are generic non-inertial coordinates, the best I can hope for is that it's going to be something that, for a fixed value of t, is going to be bent. It's going to look like something like this, expressing the fact that these are arbitrary coordinates or that spacetime is curved. OK, so it's going to look more or less like that. Actually, I need some assumptions in order to be able to get this picture, but that's not something that will concern us for the following. So let me just assume that I'm in the setting where I can do this. Mathematically, this is called a foliation. And let me call t time, OK? I just call it. I declare t as my time. So if I do this, then let's say that my configuration variables, the Q, are the value of the metric on the space part of spacetime. So of the whole metric tensor G mu nu, which I can write as, these are metrics, right? Where the indices go from 0 to 3. So I will have 0, 0 here, G 0, 1 here, G 1, 1, G 0, 2, G 0, 3. And the metric, and this matrix is symmetric. So here I have the same components. And this subsector here, in which the indices only run from 1 to 3, let me generically call it GAB. So I'm going to take this subsector here of the matrix, GAB, as my configuration variables. And then look in the Einstein-Hilbert action for terms which are proportional to derivative with respect to t. Sorry, maybe this is a sloppy notation, d over dt, or if you want, g dot. Because then I can define the conjugate variables p, a, b, as being the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to this g, a, b dot. This is what I'm going to do. And it turns out that you can do this under some assumption this is a consistent procedure. These objects here have a very simple geometric interpretation. G, A, B, the configuration variable, is what tells you the distances between points that live on this hypersurface. Okay? They only have indices in the hypersurface, so they only can tell you the distance between points here. If you want to know the distance between here and here, then you're going to need this type of indices. So it's not in your configuration variable. Your configuration variable only tells you distances between points on the same hypersurface, which is something sensible, because even here, you construct the phase space at a fixed distance of time. The phase space is not a concept that has time as a dynamical variable in it. Okay, time is frozen in the canonical picture. So, and these guys here, the conjugate variables, can be interpreted as what is called the extrinsic curvature, namely a measure of how bent this curve is when once embedded in the full four-dimensional space-time manifold. So this has extrinsic curvature zero, because it's flat when embedded in the higher dimensional, in the four-dimensional space-time. And this is slightly curved. This is more curved. So the extrinsic curvature here is bigger than here, and here is none. So it has a simple and nice geometrical interpretation. But what happens to these guys? Well, these guys are present in the action. What happens is that their time derivative is not present. So G00 and G0A, these three, and this one, do not enter as dynamical variables. Okay, their time derivatives are not present. And in fact, it is convenient to give them new names. This one, it's zero is fixed. A can vary from 1 to 3, so it's a 3 vector. And I'm going to call it NA. And let me remind you that A is 1, 2, and 3. This one up here, and so these are three quantities that parameterize this part of G0 of the metric tensor. For the first diagonal element, it is convenient a somewhat slightly more complicated recalling of the variable for technical reason. One introduces a new variable n, and then for technical reasons subtracts the scalar product of this vector here. It is not really important. It's just for completeness that I'm saying this. You can just think of NA being something, being precisely these off-diagonal components, and N squared being the G00 component. And in fact, you know that even in special relativity, space-time is not Euclidean, it's pseudo-Euclidean or Minkowskian, namely that metric tensor which I wrote as a matrix. It's all zeros, but it's not all ones on the diagonal, but it has a minus one here. By the way, both special relativity and general relativity are completely invariant under deciding that instead of being this one, the metric of flat spacetime is this one. Completely symmetric, it's just a matter of convention. However, this convention splits the physical community, because this convention here is preferred by particle physicists, because in this convention here, you get that for a relativistic particle, you get that P0 is equal, P0 squared is equal to P squared plus M0 squared. Sorry, plus E squared. No, what am I saying? Something like this. Whereas with the other convention, you get a minus there, which is not so nice. But nevertheless, this convention here is preferred by the relativists, which have no problems of describing things like this, and like the fact that space is actually just Euclidean and not with minus in front of everything. So anyway, it's just a comment on folklore. So in our case, because I like the minus there, this is a, forget about this, as I said, this is a squared number, so it must be positive. So I'm interested in having this with negative values. So I'm going to take a minus here, okay? So this is now, and so I need also a plus there. So this is just for completeness. However, what really matters is that if I do this, I might need that later, so let's go here. If I do this now, I have candidates for my phase space. So my phase space. So first of all, an obvious generalization of this is, suppose now you are in three space, or you have many particles, so that there is an index associated with I, and there's an index associated with J, with P. You know that the Poisson structure in this case is one when they are in the same time, in the same space direction, and zero otherwise, which you typically write using a Kronecker delta. That's what it means. And same for the quantum theory. Q hat, P hat is going to be I H bar delta IJ, if these now are many. Here they are many, because I have that this is a full 3x3 matrix. Not only that, but it's also defined in a space-time point. So this is a field, in fact, as opposed to a single particle system. And then my candidate conjugate variable is this P, which I've computed in this way after doing this foliation. So P, CD, which in general could be defined in any other space-time point, sorry, space point. These are just, let me use this notation to refer to the fact that time does not enter these quantities, just like time never enters this kind of classical of Hamiltonian analysis at this stage. And the fact that they do admit a classical Poissonian structure means that a structure equivalent to that one still exists. And in this case, I want this is going to be zero unless these indices perfectly match, just like in there. So I'm going to write this as A has to match to C, and B has to match to D, or because these are actually symmetric, these quantities, these tensors, are invariant under exchanging the order. So this is the same thing as GBA, which simply means that this matrix is symmetric. Then I also have the other possibility in which A could be D and B could be C that I have to include. And then I have to deal with the fact that these are defined at two different space points. And the Poisson bracket is going to be zero always unless those two space points coincide. When you require that a discrete variable has to take a definite value, well, let's say two discrete variables have to coincide, then you introduce this Kronecker delta, when you have to require that continuous variables, let's say x1 is to be equal to x2, you introduce something that is called Dirac delta, which you probably have seen in your electromagnetic course, and it has a similar notation, delta of x, sorry, of x1 minus x2. So in this case, I have one of these for each space components, right? So I want x to be equal to yx, xy to be equal to yy, xz to be equal to yz. This horrendous notation is clear enough? Maybe not. So, no, seriously, you see what I mean? All three, they have to coincide. So I want the product of three deltas, three Dirac deltas, which I have a short notation for it. I could just write the product of these three Dirac deltas. I'm just going to write that it's a Dirac delta for the two vectors, x minus y as three vectors. And to remind me that these are three vectors, I'm going to put a little three on top there to remind me. So this is the Poisson classical structure. And so in principle, quantizing would mean put heads onto these things. However, I put heads, but as I said, I also need to know what the Hamiltonian is. And I promised you that the answer would have been rather disturbing. And the reason is that if I do all of this, then my action, you know, you start from the Lagrange, sorry, you start from the Lagrangian, you do the canonical interpretation of the conjugate momenta, then you do the Legendre transform, and you end up with the action. That looks like P and Q, looks like the integral over dt of P Q dot minus the Hamiltonian. Okay? Then you take this Hamiltonian, you put heads into the quantum theory. That's what I'm trying to do. So I've started from a Lagrangian, which I didn't write, the Einstein-Hilbert action there. I've explained you what are the canonical variables of my theory. And now let me just tell you, without deriving it, what is the action in the Hamiltonian, in the canonical or Hamiltonian form. So this is going to be a function of, as it turns out, is a function of JAB, PAB, but also of those two guys there, his friends, which are not dynamical, but nevertheless, they do enter the action. So let me use, let me call them N and NA because it's convenient, as I said. So the action is now a function of all these things. And the form of this action is that it's going to be an integral over dt. And then there's going to be something that is morally, where is it? This guy here. So something that is going to be g dot p. And then what I have is minus, I have n, this function here that multiplies some function, which I'm going to call curly h, some function of g and p, minus, and then I have those three guys, n a, which each one of them multiplies another function, let me call it curly h a, and then I sum over all three of them. Okay, as usual, here I have the Einstein convention. So this is n1 times a new function, h, curly h1, which is different from h. It's a sort of a similar notation because they have a similar interpretation, as I will discuss in a moment. But these are four different functions. Each one of them is multiplied by one of these four non-dynamical variables that enter the action. Yes. Well, okay, so this is because, so here the indices are contracted, which means they are taken the same and summed over. So this is JAB, PAB. However, this is a function of not just of time, but also of space. So in fact, this is not really an Hamiltonian, this is not really and I'm talking about it's what is called a density of Hamiltonian in the sense that I also have to integrate over the cubex. But these details really do not matter for us. You'll do them once you do classical theory. What matters is that if I now study the equations of motion, so first of all, analogy with classical mechanics of a point particle, let's say, would teach me that I should call Hamiltonian this quantity here that appears on the right of the sum with a minus. In fact, without the minus, I should call it Hamiltonian. So n times curly h of GMP, these are with indices, it's just a shorthand notation, plus nA h of A of GMP. This is what I should call the Hamiltonian. However, you know that the idea of the Hamiltonian formulation of the action is that then you study the classical equations of motions by taking variations of the action with respect to the variables and equating those variations with respect to zero. I start with this. What do? I do the S over dQ equals zero, dS over dP equals zero. That's how I study the equations of motion, right? Classically. Well, among the variables that I should vary with respect to, there's N and NA. When I vary with respect to N, the only place where N enters is here, and it enters linearly, which means that the variation of this whole thing with respect to N is simply H. It enters linearly. So when I take the variation, now n is not a number anymore, but it's a function, right? These are all functions. So the variation of a function of functions with respect to functions is called functional derivative, okay? Not surprisingly. So, but to remind ourselves that it's not a normal derivative, but it's a functional derivative, we don't really use this d symbol. We try to be original and we use delta, okay? So this is just to remind us that this is not a normal derivative, but it's a functional derivative, okay? So when you take this functional derivative, think of it as just a normal derivative, n enters linearly, what I'm gonna get is just h. So this is equal to h, curly h. Maybe I could. Okay. Function of GMP. And the recipe is that this variation has to be equal to zero. Very nice. Now these other guys here. Variation of the action, functional derivative again, with respect now to the guys and A, so each of the three components. So I'm not taking the derivative with respect to a vector, okay? I don't want to fail calculus one exam. This, I mean, derivative with respect to the first component, let's say, then to the second component, then to the third component, okay? So when I take the derivative with respect to N1, let's say, N1 enters linearly, it multiplies H1, so what I'm gonna get is H1. Okay? When I take the derivative with respect to N2, I'm gonna get the function that I've called N2. So in general, the derivative with respect to NA is gonna give me the function HA. And the recipe is that this variation on the four solutions of the equations of motion, this variation is zero. And these are functions of GMP. So the classical configuration variables G and their conjugate variables P satisfy among their equations of motions the fact that this function H, which enters there, and these three functions labeled by A, which enter there, they all have to vanish, okay, on the solution of motion, on the classical solutions of the equations of motion. But if these on the solution vanish and these on the solution vanish, well, what I was trying to call Hamiltonian is 0 plus 0. It's 0. So on the classical solution of motion, there's no energy. Energy is zero. Well, what is the physical meaning of it? Well, as a matter of fact, it's precisely the physical meaning of the Rusty train equation, which you can read of as saying that the total energy content of the universe is zero. for any, so you remember those equations were something like R, so the gravitational field on the left-hand side, and then T, so the source of the gravitational field, namely the energy content of matter, on the other side. So for any positive variation in the energy content of matter, there is an equivalent variation in the energy content of the gravitational field, which is negative, that balances it, so that truly the energy content of the whole universe is always constant, is always zero. You can read those equations like this, and this, the Hamiltonian formalism, is somewhat what is telling you. So it seems like it is a bit disturbing, weird, that there's no Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is zero. But maybe we can sort of make sense of it in this sense of global equilibrium of the universe. But then how do we do the quantum theory? Well, so wait a second. I have this Hamiltonian, P and Q. I've put hats on things. I wanted to put hat on this thing, but now this is zero. Furthermore, if this is zero, what's the meaning of the rabbit in the hat? The Schrödinger equation that was supposed to be h bar of psi is zero because, sorry, h bar, which was supposed to be the Hamiltonian acting on psi is zero because the Hamiltonian is zero. So it's telling me, if I forget about this piece and just read there, it's telling me that the derivative respect to t of psi is zero. So the wave function does not depend on time. Well, this is even more confusing at first. But once again, it does make sense because we are trying to describe a theory in which we are implementing this idea that physics should not depend in any way on the choice of coordinates. You remember this idea. If I do a diffeomorphism, the physics does not change. There's no meaning behind the concept of a space-time point. So there's no meaning behind coordinates. So this splitting that we did in order to technically be able to write down the canonical formalism was not a physical splitting. This T that I call time is not a physical time. It's just a parameter which I've chosen. And what the theory is telling me is that the physics does not depend on the choice of this parameter. So this parameter should completely drop out of the physical description, which is what it does. Because the wave function psi does not depend on T. T drops out of the definition of the physics, drops out from the physics, because it's not a physical parameter. So I don't know if you have ever heard the words, but this is what is called the problem of time. Both at the classical and quantum level, we have clocks, we measure time, we experience time. Time exists, there's no doubt about that. But nevertheless, our most fundamental theory that describes gravity tells us that time is not a fundamental concept. Times depend on the gravitational field you experience. And this is so true that it actually affects, well, everyday life or whoever of you has a GPS in their cars or Blackberries or whatever. Because the four satellites that are in orbit around the Earth and that are used for the conjunction that tell your GPS where you are exactly, they feel a gravitational field which is different from the one that we feel down here. Because they are farther from the center of the Earth, they're closer to the other planets, so they feel a slightly different gravitational field, which means that the time measured by the clocks on those satellites runs differently, at a different speed. If you don't take into account the fact that time runs differently, you have an error which I think is of a few meters in the GPS. In order to get that amazing accuracy that the GPS can give you, you need to take these kind of corrections into account. So it is true that time is a relative concept. It depends on where you are in the gravitational field. So, of course, before continuing along this line, I would like to point out that there is a way out of this mess, of this conundrum, in which we don't really know how to quantize this theory here. We don't really know what is the physical interpretation of T. And the way out is, let's see if I have more, maybe here. The way out is that maybe, remember that this all started with this experimental evidence that the gravitational mass, namely the charge of an object under action of the gravitational force, is equivalent to the inertial mass. And this led to the interpretation of the gravitational field as space-time itself. Well, maybe there is a way out of this. Maybe this coincidence is accidental, and there's no real meaning behind it. So in other words, this G mu nu object which we are using, maybe we can split it into two contributions. One, which I'm going to call GB, that is really space-time. This object is classical and is what determines the distances between points. Plus another object, H mu nu. This one is the gravitational field. This one lives on top of the former. This one is a field theory, is dynamical, and has to be quantized, just like we quantized all other forces. But this one, not the whole thing. Space-time stays continuous. Space-time has a preferred time, as a causal structure, as all the nice properties of a well-defined, fixed background space-time. And the only thing that we have to quantize is this gravitational field that lives on top of it. If we do this, time takes a meaning. It is the time given by this background structure here. The only problem with this idea is that then, as I said, you can try to quantize this gravitational force, just like you quantize the other three forces that we know in nature, the strong and weak nuclear forces and electromagnetism. However, if you do this following the procedure that you follow in those other cases, this time it doesn't work. You end up with a theory that is certainly not fundamental and to some extent not so much predictive. So the usual approach does not work. One might still try to cope with the problems of the usual approach and try to improve the situation. And this is the idea behind the string theory, in which one takes this approach, tries to improve the situation, and this leads to things that you have heard last week, such as supersymmetry or extra dimensions or deep brains, which are very nice concepts, unfortunately not seen, but are promising solutions to this problem. In the rest of my talk, of my classes, I'm not going to, of course, develop that line of research, else the course will not be called loop quantum gravity, but I'm going to suggest that one can, instead of trying to go along that path, one can come back to this point and try to take seriously this coincidence between the space-time metric and the gravitational field. And I will show you that this, trying to take this message seriously, does not lead to extra dimensions or to brains or to other fancy things, but it does lead to a new picture of time, a new picture of time and a new picture of space, in which these concepts are discrete at the microscopic level, a little bit like if you were walking on the sand and you would experience a smooth sand in your feet. But if you were very, very small, you would realize that this sand you're walking on is actually made out of little grains, little chunks. And I think this is a good point to stop, or maybe there's 5 more minutes. No. Then let me take advantage of these 5 more minutes. Let me go on. So, yes, I want to do this one more thing. So if we want to try to take this message seriously, there are all sorts of problems. There are, in particular, there are interpretative problems, such as what is the meaning of time, but also technical problems, which are how do we deal with a system that is characterized by a constraint, because you'll see that these equations are equations that constrain the value of GMP to be such that this function of them is equal to 0. So both at the classical and at the quantum level, general relativity is a constrained system. So that's the technical aspect of the story, but there's also a conceptual one. And let me try to use this last few minutes to describe the conceptual ones through an example. example, which, by the way, is one of your exercises, so you better not fall asleep now, nor leave, but stay. So this example is called the timeless double pendulum. So imagine that you have two pendula, one here, M1, that is happily penduling, and you have another one here that is also happily penduling. So, and let me call, typically, how do you describe a pendulum? You describe it using the angle here, right? The elongation of this pendulum. So let me call the elongation of the first pendulum A, and the elongation of the second pendulum B. How do you typically do classical dynamics? Well, you have time, you measure time, and the Hamiltonian, let's say we're doing classical dynamics in the Hamiltonian picture, solving the Hamilton equations of motion is going to tell us how A evolves with time and how B evolves with time. However, now you are using time here, you have a clock. Now suppose your clock is stolen, which, for instance, if you are from Italy, is far from rare thing to happen. At that point, you cannot measure A and B with respect to time. However, you can do something which is similar in spirit to what Galileo did the first time that he realized that the period of oscillation is constant. Galileo didn't have a clock, he was in Italy. No, I'm joking. It was before clocks were invented. So, some there were really actually, Da Vinci had some effect. Certainly, watches were not invented. So what he did was to measure the oscillation of, what was it, like the lamp in a church. He was bored by the mass, probably, using another pendulum, his blood string. So he was measuring some oscillations using other oscillations, which, of course, might bring the question, well, if he got excited about his results, maybe his bloodstream was changing, so maybe that watch wasn't reliable. But nevertheless, let's try to do something similar. We don't have a watch anymore. We can try to use one of the two pendula as our watch, and so try to describe dynamics not anymore as A and B in function of time, but as A as a function of, let's say, B, okay? When you do this, in this new system with no time, this dynamics is not anymore encoded in the Hamilton equations of motion. So let me be a little bit more schematic. So ordinary quantum classical Hamiltonian mechanics, we have a system of two variables and a time t. You have the Hamiltonian, a function of A and B. You write down the Hamilton's equations of motion, and you end up with A of t and B of t. General relativistic scenario, there's no time. So time is dead. All we have is A and B. And what we have is not a real Hamiltonian, but it's an Hamiltonian constraint, a function of A and B that has to be equal to zero. Whereas you know that this Hamiltonian here can be any value. In fact, once you evaluate it on classical solution of motions, namely on A of t and B of t, and recall that if these are classical solutions of motion, they will depend on, for instance, the initial conditions. So they will depend on, let's say, A0 and VA0, the initial position and velocity, because these now are trajectories. And this gives you the energy associated with that trajectory, A0, B0, and so on, and the two initial velocity. Here, this is a constraint that has to be always zero. And you can read this as an equation that tells you A as a function of B. This is dynamics in a timeless system. This is dynamics in a classically constrained system, okay? This is a real Hamiltonian, this is a constraint. This is equal to the energy on the classical equations of motion. This is equal to zero on the classical equations of motion. So this is as far as the classical theory is concerned, and just as brief. So in the exercise, you will have the example will be specific. It will be two pendula, but now the Hamiltonian will be given explicitly. It will be the Hamiltonian of two pendula, so nothing Chinese. And you'll be asked to solve the system classically and also quantum mechanically, which I'm going to explain you how to do in a second. So how do we do quantum mechanics of this system here? Well, let us try to follow this procedure here. So we identified our, let's say, configuration space, and then we imposed the classical constraint and obtained a connection between the variables in the configuration space. This connection is the dynamics, is the dynamical content of the theory. Let us try to do it at the quantum level as well. So I would be starting with a wave function, which is function on those configuration space variables. So it would be a wave function on A and B. And this wave function, I'm doing just an harmonic oscillator. So it would be a wave function on the usual Hilbert space of the harmonic oscillator, which in this case, because I have two harmonic oscillators, will be Lebesgue of R squared with the usual measure. Now, as I said, the Schrödinger equation, if I put hats onto those things, so I have an Hamiltonian, which you'll be given, and quantum mechanically, this Hamiltonian becomes an operator with hats, and this operator is now acting on psi, and has to be equal to zero, we said. So first of all, the canonical structure, I've not changed it. So the canonical structure, this was equal to one. So when I put hats, this becomes equal to I h bar. And as you know, I have a representation of this algebra, which is called the Schrödinger representation, in which the operator A acts by multiplication, and the operator P acts by derivative with respect to A. And the same is true for B. So I'm not going to change this. You can use the usual Schrödinger representation for your variables. What is going to be changed is that now I have to interpret this equation as the operator acting on psi, the wave function of A and B, equal to zero. Okay? So the procedure to quantize a constraint system goes under the name of Dirac's quantization. And his idea is, forget about this part of the Schrödinger equation. We just focus on this part here. And now we interpret this equation not as an equation on H. Notice classically what was happening was that this equation gave us a relation between A and B. Here, that would not make much sense because A and B are operators. What we are going to do is that we are going to interpret this equation as a restriction on the states allowed by the quantum theory. So the states, starting from my configuration space, they live in this Hilbert space here. I'm going to read this as an equation on the state. Namely, I'm going to select only those states that satisfy this equation. They form a subspace. So let me call psi zero all those states that satisfy this equation equals zero. So the states psi zero, the collection of all of them, forms a subspace of the starting Hilbert space, which I'm going to call the physical Hilbert space. So this is a subspace of the starting point H. And those states, I'm going to call them physical. Why? Well, because they are the states that corresponds to physical configurations, such as those trajectories, I would call them physical. Only those that satisfy this Hamiltonian constraint. And I think I can stop here at this point. There's only a couple more things to say about this example, but I can see them on Thursday, and then we go back to general relativity. So of course I suggest to, because this is one of the exercises, to already give it a look, so that if you have questions, you can ask me next Thursday.